You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
If you read a lot of nonfiction, you may be familiar with what some call the memoir quandary. The complaint that memoir and autobiography are too narrowly focused on the writer's life to be of real interest to anyone but themselves. To avoid this criticism, many nonfiction writers attempt to achieve greater relatability and universality in their writing. But is this appeal really more desirable than the art of telling a good story? While there's nothing wrong with seeking common ground, one of the magical qualities of writing is how it can not only transport the reader to new places and experiences, but also introduce them to perspectives they might not have considered before. As a recent entry in the University of Nebraska Press's award-winning American Lives series, Micah McCrary's Island in the City challenges us to consider both personal and political implications of one man's life experiences through intimately intersectional prose. As a Black and queer-identifying man, McCrary examines these identities through keen exploration of gender, sexuality, race, class, geography, and more in order to comment on the simultaneous singularity and ubiquity of human experience. Though McCrary is careful to note that his is an autobiography of one man, and that he can speak for no one but himself, Island in the City is nevertheless a radical exercise in empathetic connection. Today on New Books in Literature, join us as we sit down with author Micah McCrary to hear more about Island in the City, available now from the University of Nebraska Press. Micah, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Hi, Zoe. Thank you for inviting me on.
Absolutely. So my first question about your book, Island in the City, it's part of the University of Nebraska Press's American Lives series. Could you tell us a little bit about that series?
Well, the American Lives series features mostly autobiography and memoir that is focused on different parts of living in the United States, not just geographically, but also tied to varying U.S. cultures and mostly just getting exposure for what it means to live in the United States as a place that has so much going on within it. It is intended to showcase more or less the diversity of different regions, different cultures, different ways of living in the same country.
So you yourself grew up in a small town called Normal, Illinois.
That's correct.
So my question for you is, what kind of a place is Normal? And what was your experience growing up there, as you describe as often the only Black child in your class?
Well, I currently live in Athens, Ohio, and Athens reminds me of Normal in a lot of ways, except for the fact that it's, I think, literally five times smaller. So Normal is it's a rural college town, and so it's very centered on its college and university atmosphere. It's also very centered on education and people being there to go to school. And I think that growing up there provided me a lot of ways to sort of consider this, what people call town and gown atmosphere, in that you've got this divide between people who are involved in college and university settings and people who are separate from it. And I think that in some ways that gave me access to seeing the diversity of people who come to town to attend school and who are not from Normal at all. And so I got to see many different walks of life in that way. But leaving the university atmosphere, it was much less diverse, much less varied in the ways that people acted and spoke and thought. And it wasn't just about racial diversity, but things felt much more homogenous the further away you got from the college campuses. And so what that ended up looking like for me, at least, was growing up in a place where I would be in elementary school, and as you mentioned before, I would be the only Black child in school, or the only student of color, period, in my class. And although I went to not really a large elementary school or junior high or high school, I did grow up sort of with this sense that the locals, the people who weren't just passing through because of a job or because of school, were mostly white. And so I think that I got very used to that way of living, if that's the way to put it at all. Just sort of me growing up thinking about race pretty constantly, not in any way that I felt was demeaning or heavy. Maybe they would be heavy for a child, but I think it was just sort of the way that things were. And there wasn't really any change that I could make. So I learned to live in Normal based on the way that I could perceive it and and also based on the relationships I was forming with the people I grew up with.
So speaking to some of the earlier chapters in your book, when you were growing up, a term that continues to come up is Oreo. So I was wondering if you could tell us, what is an Oreo and what are your feelings about this term, especially as it was applied by others to you?
I think I'll start with the second part of that question and saying that I'm fine with it for myself. I think that maybe I'm totally not comfortable speaking for other Black Americans in how they might feel about the term, but I'm fine with it for myself in terms of being someone who grew up with that term sort of thrown at him, especially in the environment that I was living. And for me, that also translates to, I think I quoted W.E.B. Du Bois, who said something like white sentimentality inside a Black body. And what that means is obviously being Black or African American on the outside, but having socially assimilated in ways that kind of replicate what it means, or kind of replicate ways of white living, I guess, that could be someone's dialect, that could be the way they dress, that could be the things that they were into. And so what I learned about myself growing up, and, you know, being called an Oreo as I was growing up, was that, you know, the music I listened to, because it wasn't rap or hip hop, sort of aligned me with the white kids in school instead of the Black kids in school. So did the way that I spoke, and so did the way that I dressed. And so I figured out pretty concretely that it was just, that it was their way of sort of saying that I fit in with them more than I fit in with any other Black kids who were at school.
So I'm glad that you mentioned your hesitance to speak for other Black Americans, because this is another theme that I noticed in the book. Early on, you write, please remove me from the discourse of race because I don't represent anyone but myself. So I was wondering, as a Black man who also identifies as queer, could you speak to that decision in Island in the City?
Yeah, certainly. I think that as I was writing Island in the City, I knew very firmly that I was writing autobiographically. And there are hints of cultural criticism in there as well. And I wanted it to feel as if I was talking about the way that I read the world. But it's not the same way that I think people like James Baldwin or Hilton Alls write about the world, or someone like Susan Sontag or Maggie Nelson. It's not looking at the world and making critiques about it, but rather looking at the world specifically through a very subjective lens. And even if I did critique at times, I think what I really wanted to do was just say, here is what I see, and more or less ask the reader to take that at face value. And so I think that one of the things that results in is this autobiographical writing that is sort of working inwardly and outwardly at the same time. Also something that I attempted to do, but I felt most comfortable in the position as the author to write about what I had experienced and focus on those experiences rather than saying, I know this for a fact about subject X or Y or Z. And I don't know that at the time that I was actually writing the manuscript that I could have executed it in any other way. I was in this place where autobiography felt like that's where I should be. And so I went with that, and that that resulted in something that feels very much like I am speaking to my experience, but I'm not speaking, even if there is something in common with other people's experiences. I'm not speaking for those. I'm not saying this is what we all go through in any way, shape, or form. There's no royal we here in terms of my experiences as a Black American or as a queer American.
So speaking to the latter identity that you mention, being a queer American, one of the most profound moments in the book for me was when you wrote that Matthew Shepard was actually murdered the same year, shortly after you discovered your own bisexuality. That really struck me. And so I was wondering if you could speak to sort of the stakes that raised for you as a young man coming to terms with that identity.
What I remember is just a lot of fear. I was, I think, in the first semester of seventh grade, and I felt like I had gotten to this point where I knew who I was, and I was ready to talk about it with friends, and they would even ask about it, you know, just being curious and being in this place where everyone is curious about everyone else's sexuality. But then Matthew Shepard's murder happened, and I felt not at all able to talk about it anymore because I think Laramie is in Wyoming, and I'm not sure that Normal was anything like Laramie's rural setting, but it was close enough to me for me to be afraid of how people would react if I had come out. So even though I felt ready, even though I felt I had the answers that I had been looking for, I wasn't really in a place to share those with anyone. And I think that was all about Normal. Now that I look at it retrospectively, I don't know that Shepard's murder would have hit me the same if I had actually been growing up in a city. But growing up in a place where there was a lot of farmland and I could, you know, relate or connect that farmland, however rationally or irrationally, to the way that Shepard died, it gave me a lot of hesitation. And even more than hesitation, it gave me fear. And so that influenced a lot of decisions about how I ended up expressing myself as a teenager.
So maybe speaking to that a little bit more, throughout you talk about what you call either desirous or beautiful anonymity, to not be seen, and especially not to be seen as a Black or a queer identifying man. Can you tell us a little bit about what that term means, desirous or beautiful anonymity, and why these are important to you?
I think in order to grasp onto the desirous part, I should definitely provide a disclaimer that it's my desire, but also expand on that by saying that I wanted to be someone who could blend in rather than stand out. I know that that was sometimes literally impossible, especially in the cases where I was the only Black child in a group of friends or at a party or something like that. And I think that being in a place socially where, even if that was visibly obvious, it wasn't something that anyone had to comment on. And I think that that probably came from knowing how obvious things were, maybe to use the phrase elephant in the room. I didn't want anyone to point out that was a factor or a part of what was going on socially. I'm not sure, actually. I think my desired anonymity mostly came from just being in a place where, not just a geographical place, but a temporal place, a place in my life where it was only uncomfortable to think about sticking out like a sore thumb. And so what I did was assimilate as best as I could with my friends, with the social decorum of the places where I went around, and using sort of chameleonic tools to do the best I could not to have someone notice this or that about me, whether that was Blackness or queerness.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the chapter To Rebel Against Men, you talk about the concept, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, of Menschkeit.
I think so. I'm not a German speaker, so that's how I would pronounce it as well. Yeah.
Okay. So what does that mean, and why do you personally reject it?
Well, Menschkeit, from one perspective, the perspective of masculinity, is this idea that there's a bond that men share. And that has always made me uncomfortable. I don't like the idea that, you know, two men can have this sort of relationship that is special just because of their gender or just because of their gender performance. But another perspective on Menschkeit, actually, that I learned as I was writing the book, is that a Jewish friend was talking to me about this and how it can also just mean being a good person. Menschkeit can also mean being being a man that someone can look up to because of their qualities that could be considered, you know, kindness or nobility or just things about them that just make them a good man that's separate from masculinity. And I think that what I clung to instead was this idea from, I believe it was City Hall, where Al Pacino's character combines the two. He sort of says, you know, in order to be this good man, you also have to give other men this reason to want to form a bond with you. And I was really sort of taken aback by that when I saw the movie. And I think that that also helped me sort of reflect on the ways that I had always, throughout my entire life growing up, avoided reasons to be a part of a, I don't know, a boys club or, I don't know, any situation in which boys were encouraged to do boyish things and want to, I guess, be what was considered normal. I think the only ways that I felt really comfortable with those expectations were in sports. I did grow up playing a number of co-ed sports, but many of the sports in which I played were not co-ed. I was, you know, on boys' teams. And I think that I felt a really big divide in who I was as this athlete among athletes and how, you know, that had put certain expectations on my male body and on their male bodies. And that felt acceptable. Those expectations felt acceptable because we were using four sports, but it didn't feel acceptable socially. And so I tried to distance myself from that the best that I could. I think that I still do. I'm still uncomfortable with the idea of male bonding and, you know, trying to form relationships just because of gender or physical sex. And I don't know. I think that it's just been a fact of my life, that that sense of discomfort.
Well, that segues really nicely into my next question, which is sort of a two-parter.
Okay.
The first is, how do you conceptualize male beauty? And the second is, in the same vein, what is the difference between appearing athletic and being an athlete?
In terms of male beauty, I like the idea of this male presentation that is not hypermasculine. I like the idea of being able to see the way that I could, especially, be sort of graceful, right? As someone who grew up an athlete, I thought a lot about my body very constantly. I had this very tight relationship with my body. I knew when something was right, when something was wrong. I knew what my capabilities were, what my limits were. And I wanted to use that knowledge to sort of be someone that, be someone who could impress other people with that ability. I liked being able to run the way I could and, you know, maybe hit a ball the way I could or kick a ball the way I could. It felt as though that was a way in which I was using my male body right. And I think in terms of appearances, I kind of probably imagined the way that, you know, people in audiences at sports games, for example, would see that body performing and imagined that they liked it the way that I did. That they appreciated that this body could do this or that. And I don't know, I guess in my mind, in my mind, that turned into this presentation of just knowing my body and knowing how to use it. In terms of being athletic versus appearing athletic, I was always surrounded by crowds of boys and girls who could identify with what they did athletically. That could be, you know, being the football player, being the soccer player, being the cheerleader, being the basketball player. And I think that the key for me was in this identification. I had to separate noun from verb. I played soccer, but I wasn't the soccer player. I played baseball or basketball, but I wasn't a player of those things. And I think that I had to, at least for my own sake, just let people see me as someone who could do these things, but who didn't depend on them in order to define his identity, and more or less use that as the dividing line between what I was and how I appeared.
So one of the pivotal moments in the book is your transition from having lived in Normal for your entire life to moving to Chicago, a big city. So in what ways was the transition frightening, and in what other ways was it liberating?
I think it was frightening before it was ever liberating. I'd been used to visiting Chicago, but the idea of, you know, going to sleep when I could hear taxis and ambulances and fire engines just outside the window was a really big adjustment. The idea of walking outside and not seeing any trees was a big adjustment. The idea of seeing skyscrapers every single day was a big adjustment. So when I moved to Chicago, I moved into a dorm that was downtown. And I think that being in downtown Chicago and having to acclimate to downtown Chicago was really tough, in that it was just so different from the way that I had been used to living my day-to-day existence in Normal. And it felt like there was a lot of pressure there was a lot of pressure focused on how I felt I had to act. I felt that maybe I learned this from stereotypes, but I felt that city people were just, you know, harder, or that they weren't as polite, or that there were just ways that you act when you're in the middle of a city than you do when you're in rural areas. And there were ways in which those stereotypes came to be true and ways in which they came to be very untrue. But I think that that was, at least for the first couple years of me living in Chicago, that was what I held on to. And so I think that I had to just get to know the city, not just its streets and landmarks and neighborhoods, but also get to know the people. The longer I lived there, the more I met native Chicagoans, and the more they showed me things about the city that I could learn to appreciate or even fall in love with. And I think that that helped me the most in terms of not being so shy about how overwhelming the city felt, or feeling like I was okay there, I could be myself there. There were people who wanted me to be myself there. And meeting people and getting around and not just sticking around my dorm downtown was probably the best thing for me. And that, I guess, was, to use your word, liberating, in not just a social sense, but also in a physical sense. Chicago's big, it has a lot to offer, and I just needed to sometimes literally see that in order to enhance my comfort with the city.
You write that your parents were concrete examples of upward mobility, but that you have spent most of your adult life trying to stay in the class in which you were born. So how did living in Chicago change your understanding of money and class?
I think that living in Chicago showed me how difficult upward mobility could be. I had always known about class differences growing up. I had always seen the ways that people could be divided, you know, by their neighborhoods, based on what they could afford and what they couldn't. But I think that being in the city, seeing that on a much larger scale was also much more, I guess, enlightening to me. Chicago is incredibly financially segregated, which sometimes translates to it being very racially segregated, and sort of being able to see that some people never, I don't want to use the word escape, but leave or transition from. Some people never transition from one state of being in the city to another state of being in the city. And I don't think that that was something I understood growing up, and got to understand it much more clearly being an adult there, getting around the city, seeing that there were places that people had lived for decades and they never intended to leave those places. And also that they might not even have an ability to leave.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because I intended to ask you, in the book you describe Chicago as two distinct cities bundled into one. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I think it's maybe too easy to divide Chicago into cities geographically or topographically, because a lot of people see this dividing line between the south side of Chicago and maybe not the north side, but everything north of the south side and beyond. Although that divide is there, it's kind of concrete. It's easy to see when you're traveling through the city on the train or in a car. But for me, it was much more about seeing family and friends. And so when I moved to Chicago, there were parts of the city that I only accessed based on my comfort levels. I didn't, as I said before, get around much when I first moved there. And the places I did go were places that I had been told were okay to go. I more or less followed the advice of people who'd lived there, but who I came to learn also had this idea of Chicago as being divided between its quote-unquote good part and its quote-unquote bad part. And that line started to become blurred for me as I started to visit my family more. I would leave downtown to go south of downtown and visit aunts and uncles and cousins, and that ended up being the divide that I saw. I saw that there was this part of the city that my family had been very comfortable with and ways that they learned to live, which could mean driving instead of walking everywhere or grocery shopping at certain kinds of stores, that I didn't see enacted in other parts of the city, where people felt, you know, more than safe to walk from their apartment to a corner market or get around without using a taxi. Just the ways that people utilize the city, I saw, were very, very different between the friends that I was meeting and the family that I had already living there. And even though that was divided by geography, it for me was much more divided by, I guess, senses of privilege and and the perceptions that my friends had of the city versus the city that my family had already known for decades.
So Island in the City is not just autobiographical. It's also sort of an exploration or a study of cities as an organism. So in addition to Chicago, much of the latter parts of your book take place in Prague.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, what is it about cities that people tend to romanticize, and why are people drawn to romanticizing cities?
I think that probably people come to romanticizing cities through those cities' relationships with art. And so when you give me the idea of romanticizing a city, I immediately go to think about images still in moving. So I can think about the ways that Prague is depicted, or the ways that London or Paris or New York or Chicago are depicted. And I think that I can say for myself, at least, that those are ways that I am able to imagine cities before I actually see them with my own eyes. And that's probably, I think, one of the ways that many people begin to identify with cities, especially if they are also not visiting them. They think of Paris for, you know, its Eiffel Tower and its sidewalk cafes, or London for the Big Ben and the London Bridge. I think it's just easy, basically, to equate a city with the images that are paired with that city, but those images aren't, those images are what are presented to us, but they're not the only part of the city, especially when we actually come to put ourselves in those cities, we see that there's much more.
So the book is called Island in the City, and this is also the title of one of your chapters.
Mm-hmm.
What does Island in the City mean, and why did you choose it as the title of your book?
I think that it was an accident, actually. Island in the City refers to a neighborhood in Prague called Kampa Island, which is this, well, Kampa is a neighborhood, but there's also an island right across a channel, a very small channel from that neighborhood that is an island. You have to walk maybe half of a block and then take an elevator down from the street level to the water, or to the island, as it were. And I thought that was always just something that was really unique. I'd never been in a place that had had this sort of part of itself where people would go to hang out and drink beer and socialize, that was also just right in the middle of a river. And so I thought that was something unique about the city of Prague that I had fixated on. But I think that there's this accidental double meaning to Island in the City, in that I at some point call myself an island, referring to senses of isolation when I travel. I'm very accustomed to traveling alone, and I often feel as though I'm this person who doesn't have to be noticed, this person who is just going around on his own whims. And it feels sort of, maybe not intentionally isolationist, but it feels as though I am sometimes set apart from those cities because I'm not interacting with the locals or with friends or immersing myself in those cities, but rather passing through them. And so there's definitely one intentional meaning referring to the island in the middle of the Vltava River in Prague, but an unintentional meaning in the way that I feel when I travel to these places.
So then, speaking to that, what is your concept of home, and how does one make a home for themselves?
I think that, well, I set out writing the book to answer that question, and I think that at the end, what I've come to realize, or come to at least think is that homes are places that are built up over time. They're not places where we land. They're not places where we're born. They're not necessarily places that we identify with based on our sense of nationality. I think that homes are very consciously constructed, and that could be a house. It could be, for example, my grandmother's house, which she has lived in for longer than I've been alive, and it's very much her home. But I think that it can also be the way that we have, the way that we have sought to fit ourselves within a locale. It could be this town and the ways that we have built up our social networks in that town, the ways that we have the ways that we have decided on having favorite places in that town. Just knowing that there is something that has accumulated over time, and that accumulation leads to greater and greater comfort and also love, is most likely what establishes a sense of home for someone. For myself, I have favorite places to go in Chicago. I have favorite places to go in Prague. And that's how I know that I can count those places as home to me, because they're not like other places where, even if I've visited a lot, I want to go somewhere for a sense of comfort. It's knowing that there is a place where I can be at rest and sort of rely on that as I'm hopping around from one place to another.
So I have one more question for you.
Sure.
So Island in the City is very intersectional. In this book, you touch on race, gender, sexuality, class, art, sex, very, very many facets of the human experience. And so this is sort of a broad question for you, but what are you hoping that readers will come away after reading Island of the City understanding better about one or all of these topics?
I hope that a reader comes away from Island of the City thinking about how nuanced the world is. I think that one of the things that I try to express in the book is how I look at place and how many different shades there are to that place. It's not just about me interacting with a place on a surface level, but also looking at what's beneath that to see how the people in that place perceive it themselves, how my perception lines up with that, whether that perception has been correct or incorrect. And also looking at those different layers of nuance to realize how people form their own senses of identity in the places where they go or the places where they live. I think that through this book, I've looked at the world very intersectionally, by not just attempting to look at any one facet of the place that I'm talking about, but saying, or rather asking, what else is here? What else is possible to know about this place as I not just regard it, but also explore it? And how can that get me to not just understand the place better, but also understand myself as a human being who reads and reacts to the world, hopefully with compassion, but also understanding when I do so out of fear or do so out of anger, just sort of doing my best to get to the bottom of how all that works. And I know that that's a lot to ask, but it's certainly what the book aims for. I've joked before that the book is a better person than I am, And I hope that readers will come away from the book trying to see that this book is an attempt at just being better at living as I get older and as I get around, and that they can find ways to do that as they age as well.
Wonderful. Well, Micah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for your time, Zoe.
My name is Zoe Bossier, and you've been listening to New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thanks for listening.